everybody. Welcome to episode 97 of the Alexis Sale podcast. And this sounds spontaneous. In fact, Talal failed to notice that Rish was just doing his audio through the MacBook speakers rather than his own.
You'd have to tell them that.
Microphone. So we're now going to have to restage the spontaneous banter that we had in the first episode, because it has to be exactly the same. So, hi, Nish. Thank you for coming on my podcast.
It's my pleasure, Alexi.
It's a quid pro quo for me going on your podcast.
It was in the rider, the sale rider.
Okay, well, I got that out of the way. So, Nish, I mean, you know, tell me all about yourself, really. I mean, just really how you got started and, you know, the whole...
I've been doing comedy for nearly 20 years now, but I got started in the, I think, the lowest form of artistic expression known to humanity, the student sketch comedy group.
Oh.
The student...
Improv?
Not improv. It was sketch comedy.
Right. So, where was this at? Okay.
Durham University.
Okay.
And so I started going to Edinburgh probably in 2000 and I definitely know it was 2006. I started going to Edinburgh in 2006. And I was, I think, very lucky to kind of be in a group with a bunch of people that I still am friends with today. And like one of them, Tom Neenan, who was the head writer on the MASH report and has done all sorts of work. We've done all sorts of work together. And the other one was Ed Gamble, who is a sort of the king of podcasting. Right. And I think they were like, Gamble was like much more across the professional elements of what being a comedian involved. So he knew about gigs and the circuit and that you had to email and call people to try and get those gigs.
Right.
And so, yeah, I was pretty lucky to be coming in with those kind of guys.
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it, whether that's like luck or, you know, you seek out, you know, fellow people of talent, really.
You've got to have a gang, I think.
Now, well, I always often quote the, you know, the Hall of Residence at the art school in Madrid in sort of, 1918, when, you know, Picasso P., Miro J, Dali S. I mean, it was extraordinary just on that, you know, there's just an extraordinary coming together of talent, really, in that one institution. You know, I mean, a huge number of artists who obviously subsequently changed the world. And so you don't know whether, you know, what brings that about, that kind of gestalt, I suppose.
I think sometimes the temptation is to kind of venerate the individual, right? And not necessarily appreciate that they sort of came out of a context. Like, I always think about it in terms of, I was such a fan of 60s. I mean, I'm literally recording this wearing a Jimi Hendrix t-shirt. I've just realized as I look at my self-view camera. And, you know, like the Beatles were sort of in competition with the Stones, and they were sort of in competition. Like, Brian Wilson listened to Rubber Soul over and over and over again and sort of was so fixated with its content that it kind of drove him to do even more sonically interesting and experimental things with the Beach Boys. And when they released Pet Sounds, it had the same sort of effect on McCartney. And, you know, the Beatles listen to Dylan, their lyrics become more sort of ambitious and introspective. And Dylan listens to the Beatles and starts playing with a full electric band. You know, these things are always, everybody's always in conversation with each other. Yeah. I don't know how this leads to me doing the MASH report and Ed Gamble doing Off Menu. I don't know.
Are you Dylan or are you the Beatles? Or?
I don't know where this analogy leaves me and Ed Gamble.
And of course I was completely alone, so I didn't have any of that.
You had a big group.
Shut up. No, there was nobody there. It was just me. I invented everything.
Yes, yes, you did, Alexi.
There was nobody else there.
Yeah. What was the name of the sketch group? I need to know. Sorry.
It was just the Durham Review. It's a student sketch group. It still continues to exist to this day.
The Durham Review.
Yeah.
What were you studying at Durham?
English literature and history.
Good.
But it sort of all went out of the window when I started doing it. I had weirdly such a vocational experience at university because all we did was put on comedy shows and like fly them and make the flyers ourselves, do the postering. We used to have to stand on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh trying to get people to see. That'll teach you humility. Yeah. When somebody says, ooh, I don't want a fucking flyer and it's got a picture of your face on it, that will definitely take you down a peg or two, which is probably a good thing for me.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it? Somebody said, a flyer when I was up there this year, somebody said to me, I can't remember what it was now. Are you interested in, you know, Renaissance art? And I just said, no. He'd never actually had that response before, really. So, no, I'm not. No.
How do you feel when you go to Edinburgh now and walk around the fringe?
Thank you for that, Nish. I find it, yeah, because I was up there. I was up there for a couple of nights this time, just doing
comic strip thing.
Q&A, which was fine, but you know, fills me with revulsion. the desperation really gets to me. I don't know. I'm not saying my views are valid, really.
Yeah.
It makes me uncomfortable, you know. I don't know if it's Oppenheimer, it's one of the inventors. Is it Einstein? Yeah, it said, you know, when he heard about the nuclear bomb, if I had known what I was doing, I would have become a watchmaker.
I'm interested in asking you. Like, to some extent, we are all, you are part of...
I invented that shit.
You're part of a creation myth of British alternative comedy.
It's the truth.
No, but Alexi was part of the first people to bring comedy to the fringe.
I was the first person. Me and Tony Allen were the first people to do...
That's what I mean. I wonder how you feel. Are you like Cillian Murphy at the end of that movie, just in your hat in the rain, contemplating the destruction you've wrought?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes, very much. It's an age thing in that I think it must, and there's probably an element of kind of envy here that I think if you could, I think it must still be the most amazing experience if you're younger and you're caught up in it and, you know, it was when I went back in 2013, I absolutely loved it. I was the happiest I've ever been, really. I still had that. I was through, you know, because I hadn't done stand up for 17 years, and it just to be back in that mix, I can remember as being joyous, really. And I some of my unease about it now is, I guess, to do with just not being a part of it, really. If you're doing a show and it's all your mates and, you know, I suppose, some of the realization is just a realization of age, really. I don't know if I said, I remember when I did 2017.
Yeah.
And going out for a walk on the meadows one day and seeing this girl just sobbing and being, and a mother, posh mother, going, oh, it's all right, darling, we'll go and have a nice tea. And I said to my promoter, to David Johnson afterwards, what's that all about? And he said, it's Black Wednesday. It's when you've got no reviews and your venue is empty, and there's a specific Wednesday, really, when you know you're not going to get any reviews. Yeah. And you've wasted you know, your time up there. So it's savage as well, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, which is what perhaps what gives it. It's also piquancy. I mean, reputations are made and reputations are lost. I mean, I loved it in 2013. I was so happy.
Yeah.
And I loved the show that I was doing. And in 2017, I was less happy with the show, and I was 5 years old, four or five years old.
It's always a personal experience.
It's
going to affect. But 2013, I think, was one of the last years, I think up to 2015, maybe, that it was at its peak, really, like good. You've done it a lot of times, I'm assuming, Nick.
I've done it a lot over the last, I've done it almost, I think I've done full runs there almost every year, apart from 2017, 2020, obviously, and 2020. 2 and 3. So in some of those years I was up there for a couple of days, but like I've done full months for most of the last 20 years. And it is like, it is interesting because you kind of go through an arc with it. Like I've done it at every level it's possible to do it, really, like student stuff, free fringe shows where you pass a bucket round at the end, full whack, paid venue, North Korean style propaganda posters of your face slapped all over the city. And sort of then graduating into a kind of, you know, I'm loath to use the term elder statesman, but certainly like kid who's been held back at school a couple of years and is bigger than all the other kids. I've sort of done it at every stage. And it is interesting because, you know, you do see the kind of increased corporatization of it. And you do see the increasing costs that are slightly boxing out younger generations from being able to do it. And that does make me sad, only because if you take away the sort of the career-making, career-breaking, whatever it is, element of it, the best thing about it really for me was for just a couple of years, I was doing stand-up every day for a month. And the kind of... again, like I'm embarking on a metaphor that I don't fully feel confident in because I don't exercise enough, but I imagine it feels like what being in the gym is when you're in a kind of period of, there's like a period of match fitness you get, you know, where you sort of come back in September and the first time you do 5 or 10 or 15 or even 20 minutes after doing an hour every month, you're like, this is child's play to me. Like this is nothing to me anymore. I did 5 solo shows consecutively. No, 4 maybe. No, actually it was 5. I did 5 consecutively. So every year I wrote a new hour of stand-up and I went and did it at the Fringe. And the last 2 I then immediately took on national tours. And I think I'm not sure you'd want to do that for more than that period of time. But what I will say is the experience of doing that has like stood me in a good stead.
Yeah.
And probably there's a sadness about me that I'm never going to do that again, really. But treasure these moments, Nish.
I was thinking I'm interested in your sense, how much of a sense you have of the like legacy of alternative comedy, the kind of the legacy that you hold,
yeah,
and the sort of space that you occupy in British comedy, because it's you know, it's a really important part of the evolution of the medium and the art form in this country.
Does that
make you feel like a museum piece when people speak about you like that? That's what I think that's the thing that I'm interested in.
Well, when I sort of decided to go back to stand up, I first of all spent like a year with a younger comp, just going around and going watching gigs to find out how the scene had developed, really. And I did really like the way when I went, you know, backstage in some dressing room, all the comedians would have to pretend to be excited that I was there.
Standing in a row waiting to shake your hand.
That gave me tremendous pleasure. I think
oh, I love
I'm really very happy with where I am now, because I think that my work is still innovative and is still connecting with a large audience, really. So I feel very self-satisfied about that. I mean, tremendous sense of self-congratulation that, you know, with the dance videos and this and, you know, particularly Sandwich Bar and Radio 4, that is still reaching a massive audience. So I feel I'm perfect. I mean, I'm happy with that also being a kind of historical monument is fine, because I think that I've moved, you know, I've managed to move on and be as innovative in a way as that, you know, to do new things and to be, you know, I have friends who are musicians who do like that rewind circuit.
Yeah.
They're happy doing it and there's an audience there, but it's not something I would, you know, well, you can't really do that with comedy.
No.
Well, maybe you can, I don't know, but so I'm full of complacent self-congratulation about the fact there was a period, I think there was a period like in the 90s, you know, I was talking when we went for a drink the other night with Sammy Abbott, I was talking about 1990s Alexis Sale.
Yeah.
1990s Alexis Sale was very unhappy, really, because he was very out of fashion, really. I mean, there was a period, you know, he was hanging around the Zanzibar Club in his unstructured Armani suit with Anthony Worrell Thompson. I know that I can't, you know, I don't know, Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen, I don't know, other figures from that, Lee Dixon. And
that's a great first three 1990s names that you can think of. Anthony Worrell Thompson, Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen, and Lee Dixon. That really sums up a specific version of the 1990s.
That was my life, yeah. There was a club, who was it? One of the other Lees, the footballing Lees that was married to, oh God, it was the girl in Quadrophenia.
Leslie Ash.
Who she married to, still married to him, I think.
Lee Chapman,
yeah.
Right.
Okay. A4. He did something very funny once, though. He said, I was in there. And I think he was being interviewed by a journalist or something. And I came up and said hello. And he said, oh, remind me, mate, where did we play together? Which I thought was the most brilliant. And I couldn't remember which teams he played in. Because I thought I should have said Leeds. And it was a very funny thing for him to say.
What a great compliment on a 1990s Alexis Sale's physique.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, he was slim and out
of shape ex-footballer is still an out of shape ex-footballer. That's still more in shape than 90% of the population.
Well, why did I go? Oh yeah. So anyway, so I really embrace and sort of wallow in that the historical contest. I'm very context of it happened, and you know, I both consciously, you know, I mean, that's partly a joke, but it's also there's a, you know, that I, you know, that kind of claim that I invented everything
and yeah,
there was nobody else. It's partly just self-serving, you know, I mean, again, kind of Kim Jong-un kind of yeah, I learned from the Marxist-Leninist who I followed when I was younger, but it's also, you know, I think so I don't mind doing a bit of that, really. But I think if I wasn't doing work that was still interesting, I would have a different attitude to it, I think. Really.
I wonder if it's easier for comedians to embrace elder statesperson status because by virtue of being a comedian, you're still producing new work. You know, like you say, there is not a possibility. Or maybe there is and we're all just... we're just not aware of it, but there, if you're still working as a comedian, you have to produce new material. You can't really go out and, I saw the Rolling Stones live. It wasn't, nobody was clamoring for them to do new songs. They wanted to hear
no,
you know, satisfaction, and you can't always get what you want. It's whereas maybe that's where sometimes musicians are more prickly about being perceived as like legacy act.
Yeah, I mean, by definition, if you're still working as a comedian, you have to be doing new material. So you have to be innovating to a degree. Yeah, you can't go out and do the old. I mean, people have suggested I did go out, and I don't know what it would be like to go out in the tight suit now. And you know, hello, John, got a new. I mean, I did towards the end when I was really disillusioned, sort of in the late sort of mid '90s when I was coming up to stopping touring, and I would do me hit at the end. I would do Hello, John, got a new motor, and I would start putting in kind of demeaning line. You know, I'd say this is a bit fucking pathetic. I've been doing this for 15 fucking years, and the audience could kind of go, oh, this is a bit unsettling. This man clearly isn't happy with his life. And I was glad to, I was glad to bin all that. But so I don't mind doing nostalgia stuff as well. I mean, it's like talking about the comic strip or talking about the young ones, stuff like that, really. It's fine, really. I also think, yeah, I mean, and it is, I think for a while, I mean, like I say, in the 90s, people really didn't, they rejected, I think there was a rejection of the history of, my sense of it is, and this may be that there was, you know, with the sort of when that alternative, the first alternative comedy camp boom kind of came to an end, and you got people like Badil and Skinner and people, you know, I mean, the best you could say about their comedy was it was apolitical.
It was very apolitical because this is a comedy that I was watching or that was on a lot on TV when I was growing up, really, like the sort of the kind of that sort of fantasy football era, and it sort of seemed like it kind of didn't have a fixed political identity.
No, well, probably, which makes it racial, makes it reactionary by definition, I think. But there was also I've sensed an aggressive kind of rejection of the history of comedy, of modern comedy, really. And so I felt like I was kind of very much out of fashion for a few years. And then I noticed that started to change in the sort of when I started to come back to comedy, really. And, you know, but I'm very grateful for that attention. I also know that there was a point when that attention wasn't there. That's also fine, you know. I think that's also something you've got to live with. Is the sine wave of a career that you will be in and out of fashion. Really, I think I'm kind of pretty much set now.
You know, but, did you? Why did you become disillusioned in the 90s? Why did you stop touring?
Well, because I think because I felt like the wind had changed. So what I was doing was no longer connecting with people in the same way that it did, really.
Yeah.
But I was still doing me hit and all that. And I felt like I was trapped a bit in that.
You had a couple of, you tried to break America and stuff and it went
terribly wrong. Yeah.
You came back with your tail between your legs. That must have knocked your ego a bit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's not...
And you had
this
like
isn't your role. I think we're stepping outside. I think there'll be an advert in Podcaster Weekly, popular podcast looking for
the
new.
Fuck, it's well established. You went and made a tit of yourself in front of the Golden Girls and came back to London. You create the canon. I'm just reciting it. The Golden Girls sent you packing. Said, fuck off out of America. We want Omid.
They did. I think it takes, I don't know, I mean, it takes a long time to, when you've set a kind of a template, it takes a long time to kind of turn that oil tanker around, as it were.
My analysis is you were so like on the pulse and so underground, and that's what made you who you were. But then the 90s, you were too big. You were so famous and so successful. And then I can't imagine going back to the stage and having to like keep trying to act like you're punching up when you are like the top of the top at that point. So how?
Yeah, there was a contradiction in that. Yeah, I'm still putting that ad in the podcast weekly, but I mean,
I wonder, Nish, if have you always been, because you're considered a political comedian, especially with the MASH report,
yeah,
as kind of being on in everyone's homes, you know, for a few years. That show was fucking great. But when you left the Durham Review, was that kind of your intention? Were you political in your stand-up from the beginning?
I mean, I should say that there's probably one bit of my background that I've selectively omitted, and James Acaster is always very keen for me to stress and repeat this to people, because when he found out about it, he said it made a lot of sense. When I was at school, my like extracurricular activity was debating. So I was like in the debating society, and the thing that I did in my fucking debating speeches was fill them with jokes. So there would be like a kind of argument that I was trying to advance, and then the way that I would move from one point to another was a joke. Like I would write stuff, funny stuff to put in. And when I told James that, who I thought was my friend until he laughed in my face when I told him this story.
Yeah.
He thought he and betrayed me with his laughter. He said, "Oh my God, you should always tell everyone that, because it makes so much sense of your comedy and personality."
Yeah. It does.
I think I was always interested in pop. Also, when I was a kid, one of the first stand-ups I ever saw and was conscious that I was watching stand-up was Chris Rock in those kind of late 90s, early 2000s HBO specials. The first one I saw was Bigger and Blacker. And that stand-up show opens with him coming out and talking about the Columbine Massacre. That's literally the opening. Once he has said, "Thanks, nice to see you all," he's shouted out Brooklyn. And then he says, "I was on an elevator and four high school age white men got on and I jumped off because I said, 'You're not killing me.'" Like that's how the thing starts. And so I think a lot of what I understood from minute one, what I was conscious of the idea that if you could do stand-up comedy and it could be hugely politicized and it could like engage with real world issues. And I think if you watch some of those late 90s, early 2000s Chris Rock specials, you see a squeaky voiced man of color screaming about the news and you think, I've not progressed far from teenage debating and Chris Rock HBO specials. But when I was doing stand-up initially, it was all just like anecdotal, because I think I had to learn how to write jokes, because I would try and do political stuff, but it would just be me sort of slightly jokelessly meandering through some opinions. And I had a couple of years where I learned the mechanics of joke writing and was slowly then able to integrate my opinions into my act in a way that was still funny, but also honored the passion that I have for a lot of those political opinions.
Me and Chris Rock also share something, and we're both great stand-ups, have been in some fucking terrible movies.
Yeah. You said it. And
his career is an act.
A handful of good ones.
I feel like Alexi's now trying to head Talal off. Yeah. He's trying to get out in front of the story.
And I've never advertised a betting site like Chris Rock does at the moment.
What's going on? What?
I don't know. I suppose it's that thing where it's in a foreign market, so you don't think your reputation is at stake, really, so you can advertise.
But in the sort of internet era, it's not, you know, there's no such thing as kind of an isolated foreign. You can't really Bill Murray, Lost in Translation, whiskey advert your way through no, anonymously to a couple it's of million quid,
isn't it? But they, you know, if you get offered $5 million for half a day's work, like it's really hard to say no to that. I can only imagine.
And the economics of rich people. I think I've what I've realized is, and I, listen, and I say this in full knowledge that I am much wealthier. You know, I am a wealthy person by any discernible metric. If you consider global averages and even national averages within the United Kingdom, I am a wealthy person. But I slowly am starting to realize I actually don't understand the economics of being a rich person, because sometimes you see somebody on an advert and you're like, why the fuck do you need to?
Yeah.
What? What are you doing?
Oh, doesn't it?
Is there any light you can shed on that, Alexi? Because you don't partake in that, but you must have friends that you see on telly and, like, without naming names, but like, how do you understand what that is? It as simple as what I said? It's like they're just offered a massive paycheck for hardly any work, and
yeah, some of if you've got no morals, or you know, your kind of fluid morals, that
fluid
helps.
Morals.
My observation of sort of rich people is that you live in a world that's, you know, I mean, it's that line, isn't it, that money is how rich people keep score, really. So, yeah. They live in a world of, you are more beset by rules and by hierarchy. You're free of that if you're poor. The rich are continually ranking themselves and you have to wear this kind of fucking suit at this kind of dinner, and you have to outdrive this kind of car, and you have to go to this kind of place. And it's a horrible kind of life, really, in some ways. If you're participating in that kind of competition of the rich, really.
There's a really great exchange in a Succession episode that I think gets at some of that, where one of the characters is talking about receiving, I think, $2 million or $3 million in a kind of settlement, and the other characters are disparaging that option for him, yes, and saying that would make you the poorest rich person in America.
Yeah.
And I always think about that I think that exchange is part of why that show is so good, because I think it gets at something about the alternative reality that you start to occupy.
Yeah.
If you choose to become rich and then allow yourself to be untethered from reality, if you completely change the sort of rules by which you view economics.
Yes, absolutely. But it's also that, you know, I mean, it would be fine all that if they weren't also destroying the planet in their quest for kind of status, you know, but they're monsters, you know. The genocide in Gaza is because of, you know, people, in a way, you know, Henley Regatta, in a sense. I mean, that's a bit of a, you know what I mean? It's the whole hierarchy of the wealthy all across the world. It's all connected, really, I think.
Yeah, I think that there's, I think, you know, it's having this conversation on whatever it is, Thursday, after the Saturday, whatever you want to call it, protest, race riot, whatever that thing was that happened in London.
Yeah.
There's an important image in that, and that is the image of Tommy Robinson, Stephen Yaxley Lennon, stood next to Elon Musk on a video call. Because in that moment, it's like the Trump inauguration, having the CEOs of Google, Amazon, Meta, Twitter, you know, and it shows you everything, which is there is a kind of alliance between a kind of Christian, ethno-nationalist, white supremacist, fascistic movement and deregulated capital.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they have the same objective ultimately, which is state smashing. And whether that's because you want to drag us back in social progress terms to the mid-19th century, or it's because you want to smash the state because there is huge financial upside in a lack of functioning government for a lot of these people. They have shared aims.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying Chris Rock is doing that just because he does an actor. That's Sky Bet or whatever it is.
We can't,
Las Vegas.
pin that on the giant Ray Winston floating head. We cannot pin that on the floating Ray Winston head that appears when I'm trying to watch football and asks me if I've updated my acca. I don't know what an acca is, Ray. I just want to watch some people kicking a ball around. Please.
Yeah, well, you can and you can't really. I mean, I think maybe Chris Rock just wanted to buy a boat and they gave him. I don't fucking know. We are having moved on to that subject rapidly from Chris Rock. It's hard to overstate, I think, how much it feels that we are in a perilous.
Yeah.
Tipping point, really.
100%.
Yeah. And, you know, it's to watch something like the Labour parties, Keir Starmer's Labour parties, connivance in this, you know, on a local level is.
I support flags. Yeah. I've always loved flags.
I was talking about this on my podcast yesterday. If you separate all the morality out of it, which I feel like I say constantly, and you probably shouldn't, you definitely shouldn't separate the morality out of things, you know.
Separate the morality out of Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, if you,
just take the morality out of it, and then he was just providing a home for indigent young women. Yeah, anyway,
well, after Jeffrey Epstein died, Norm Macdonald, I would say, tweeted like one of the all time great. Like Norm Macdonald had like a really, you know, string of extraordinary turns of phrase.
Yeah.
But I think his tweet about Jeffrey Epstein is one of the kind of all time. It's something. I'm just looking up. So yeah, it's a man is a coin, no obverse without reverse. If you like, remember Jeffrey Epstein is a monster destroying lives with a wicked nonchalance. But for me, I will remember him as the man who killed Jeffrey Epstein.
That's brilliant.
R.I.P. Norm.
Such a loss, Norm Macdonald. Remember?
Yeah, completely.
Just say it, you know, I get random stuff comes up. That bit where he's talking about dogs and how Hitler's dog really loved him. I mean, loved Hitler. I think it was just, yeah, that's a brilliant fucking line, though. I'm so envious of that.
It's a brilliant line.
Yeah, yeah.
But even if you take the moral obligations out of it and you take what we expect from the leader of a Labour Party, it feels like you're not learning the lessons of British history and the British politics in the 21st century, which is you can't defeat Nigel Farage by aping his rhetoric, because the Conservative Party has been doing that really for like my entire adult life now.
Yeah.
They've been trying to do that for two decades, and it's taken, you know, they sort of tout themselves as the most successful political party in the history of global democracy in terms of their election wins. It's taken them to the precipice of total destruction. It's consistent because it there was a big study by a bunch of academics, a pan-European study that warned centre-left parties that aping the rhetoric of the far right only legitimizes them. It doesn't actually do the thing that it's supposed to do, which is cut it off at the pass.
Yeah.
And also it means that you're doing deals with, or you're trying to appeal to people that have no interest in you. Joe Biden flew to Israel and hugged Benjamin Netanyahu. Joe Biden's entire political legacy will now forever be associated with the genocide in Gaza and the return of Donald Trump to the presidency.
Yeah.
And a huge part of Trump's return to the presidency can be pinpointed at alienating core Democratic voters by supporting Netanyahu. And Benjamin Netanyahu has recently said that if Donald Trump had been president in 2023, October 7th wouldn't have happened. So the guy that Joe Biden put his entire political stock in has had so little respect for him as a man and as a politician. And it's very alarming to see Keir Starmer as the leader of the Labour Party, be unable to learn basic political lessons from what's happened in America, but also, yes, probably more importantly, what's been fucking happening here for the last 25 yes. years.
Have you got any insights onto, is it just stupidity or is it corruption that they're bought and paid for by, you know, the billionaire oligarchs? I mean, have you got any insight into why they're doing that stupid shit?
I'm going to surprise you when I tell you the Labour front bench is not in direct contact with our podcast and has not been hugely cooperative. That we've had wonderful conversations with Labour MPs, but it's probably worth noting very few of them are still part of the front bench or were part of the front bench when we had conversations with them. I honestly couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you, you know, it's an almost Shakespearean arc for Keir Starmer to go from being a human rights lawyer who defends peaceful protesters defacing military equipment that's going to be sent to Iraq and Afghanistan to a prime minister who prescribes a peaceful protest group as a terrorist organization. It feels like a kind of, it feels Shakespearean in its sort of tragic circularity.
Yeah. I mean, my sense is, I suppose, that corruption, that the real him is, if there is an authentic him, is this guy. It's not
right.
The human rights lawyer was just something he was doing on the way to becoming this guy, really. Whether he knew it or not, I suspect. I came to your podcast the other Sunday. I mean, I was on it. And then I came the Sunday after you had...
to see Zara, yeah.
Zara
Sultana,
How did you find... that?
Well, you know, I think there's something very depressing about the idea that the Labour Party doesn't have room for someone like her in it.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, especially at a time where we're talking about, hey, how do we animate young voters? How do we talk to our electorate that is consuming most of its media through online platforms in a way that feels authentic to those platforms? Okay, so now you have here, you know, a young person who is an excellent communicator, really, really excellent speaker, and is authentic and native to the very internet platforms that you are desperately trying to get a foothold into. Mm-hmm. So you have this, like, you know, young modern communicator who is trying to express progressive political ideas that I would think most core Labour voters would subscribe to, which is, you know, addressing wealth inequality, pushing, like, undoing the damage done by the legacy of the Cameron and Osborne austerity project, taking a stand against a genocide happening in the Middle East, standing up for ethnic minorities and standing up for women's rights and the LGBTQIA community. I mean, this is fucking basic stuff. Like, this is... if the Labour Party is not going to stand up for those things, then you start to question, well, what is the Labour Party for?
Yeah.
And again, you get into this not learning lessons thing. There's so much hand-wringing and analysis about what happened to the Democrats in the States. But a huge part of it is you cannot... the one thing I will say, we constantly talk about what we need to learn from this kind of nativist far-right project that's happened in the last decade in a lot of Western European and American countries. They never alienate their core vote. The right never, ever whacks its own base. Now, look, sometimes... I'm proud sometimes. The left is maddening because of the amount of sort of infighting and the amount of time we spend yelling at each other. But in some ways, I'm proud that we actually still have progressive people still debate things with each other and still try and find, you know, improve ourselves as a movement by arguing. Sometimes it's the most frustrating thing in the goddamn world. Whenever I see in right-wing newspapers, they're like cozy consensus on the left, I'm like, what fucking cozy consensus are you talking about? What are you talking about? But the thing that watching right-wing parties over the last decade, just, you know, reasonable conservatives allowing themselves to be dragged into supporting hard-right nativist projects that they, you know, every Republican, there's a quote about them talking about how unfit Donald Trump is for office. You know, David Cameron comes to power as conservative leader in this country and he says, we need to end our obsession with Europe. and describes Eurosceptic conservatives as, I think it's loonies, fruitcakes and closet racists. That's Cameron's phrase for Eurosceptic conservative MPs. And then he ends up handing them the Brexit referendum. So it is a thing that I'm frustrated by. I think the right wing of politics has not done enough in fighting. But what I would say we can learn from them is you never want to alienate your base. The Progressive Party should not be not alienating young voters, which are a huge part. They should be animating young voters to get. The problem with young people is that historically, they've just never voted enough in elections, right? In terms of if you're viewing it through the lens of a Progressive Party. So what you don't want to do is alienate the young people that do vote, because statistically they are likely to come out and vote for you. And what you don't want to do is alienate minorities of any description, because again, that like we're not naive. Like the minorities of this country are not naive enough to believe that we've always just picked the least racist party and voted for it. You know, we're not unaware of racism that is and has existed within the Labour Party. We know about it. We know that they're less racist than the fucking other guys. So like, why you would want to alienate those people is sort of beyond me.
That's assuming
possible, isn't it?
That's assuming Labour is progressive, you know.
True.
Which they're not anymore. You know, it's clearly they're not. Something has corrupted them.
Well, it's like Lenin said, the Labour Party, you know, supports the working class. It is controlled by the bourgeoisie and the worst of the bourgeoisie at that. And Lenin could see that in the 1910s. They are the worst of the. In many ways, they're the worst people in the world. I think the Labour kind of right wing. They're just terrible beyond belief. Really. But people sometimes say, if I was talking to, you know, let's just have a left party which replicates the right in its effectiveness.
Yeah.
And the trouble is we can't do that, can we? I don't think it would work. I mean, if it would work, then fine. Yeah. You know,
unfortunately, we have fucking standards.
But that, I know, and it's a fucking nuisance, isn't it, to have morality. It gets in the way of, you know, of all kinds of things.
And but also, it's fundamentally easier to be conservative. And part of that is because if you say anything vaguely supportive of conservative movements, there is a very sophisticated Goebbels-like propaganda operation willing to disseminate that information. I mean, people wonder how Brexit happened. But if you look at the front pages of the Mail, the Express, the Sun, the Telegraph, there's been some terrific journalism done by the investigative journalist units at the Times newspaper, but the op-ed pages of the Times have just been filled with bile about immigrants and immigration. Yeah. And there was this, you know, this naive idea that social media would be this new democratized space, but social media companies are owned by tech oligarchs, and they have the same agenda as Murdoch and Musk are not dissimilar people. They Musk might dress differently and he might behave in a way that Murdoch might find crass, but they have the same basic objectives. They're the same fucking guy.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, just, you know, it's updated technology. I think as well, if you want to be a right-wing person, all you have to do is just take the worst part of your personality and just give it free rein. Just say, I will never, you know, kind of mitigate my envy or greed, or just give it, you go, off you go, son. The darkness within us. Just there you go. And then immediately you'll be a right wing supporter, won't you? Whereas what the left is trying to do is to offer people, I think, that, you know, to be the best person they can be, but that sort of requires a bit of intervention, doesn't it? In a sense, you have to think, hang on a minute, you know, my anger is misdirected, and I don't know where I'm going with this. But
there isn't a left or progressive version of Make America Great Again or Take Back Control.
No.
Because they're both phrases that imply recapturing of a lost time that we have to get our country back to. David O'Doherty, one amazing stand-up and one of my great pals, used to, in kind of 2016 and 17, he did a bunch of shows about the experience of living in Ireland but spending a lot of time in the United Kingdom working. And as the United Kingdom Brexited and started to sort of seemingly kind of embrace much more regressive political ideas, Ireland started doing things like legalizing gay marriage and allowing women to have abortions. And he had this kind of, he did these shows over that period where he through various routines, he talked about the sort of strange experience of feeling proud of Ireland and like feeling proud of his country, especially in contrast to the way its immediate neighbor, with whom it has obviously a historically fractious relationship, was behaving. Mm. But he had this great thing about how on the back curtain, he sometimes uses white tape and puts DOD on the back of the curtains. And at one of the shows, he, on the back curtain, it said MIRFT, FTF. It was an acronym that I don't have the ability to remember whilst also talking at the same time, but it wasn't explained through the show. And at the very end, he talked about how Make America Great Again can't translate to Ireland because the history of Ireland is so miserable. And he said the only way you could do that, and it was the acronym spelled out, Make Ireland Reasonable for the First Time. And he was like, that's partly what the premise of the routine was, in some ways it's easier for Ireland to be progressive because right-wing Irish people
start on such a low base.
Can't point to some like imagined, you know, even if it's fabricated, there isn't even the kernel of truth. You know, I think for white Americans, I think there is this sort of, you know, nostalgia for the 50s, maybe the Eisenhower era. For a lot of the British aristocracy, there is a genuine nostalgia for empire. You know, there is an idea that Britain was the center of the universe. Yeah. And that is the specific time they're trying to get back to. And you can't really say that. And you can't just fully say that because you can't say what you really mean, which is, I wish we still owned black and brown countries. But so you sort of couch it in, you know, we need to take our flag back. We need to take back control. And, you know, control of what is the sort of interesting question. Yeah. And when you start pulling at that thread, you realize, oh, okay, it's actually a sort of, the whole thing is sort of imperial white supremacist fantasy almost.
Because
we don't pull at that, like, we just talk about like patriotic things that you're patriotic about. And none of those campaigns ever sort of go, you know, if you were being patriotic, I do find patriotism loosely embarrassing, but if I was being patriotic and I was really trying to think about things that make me proud to be British, you know, the National Health Service is genuinely a sort of miracle. You know, it's obviously incredibly complicated and there was a huge amount of wrangling. It took a huge amount of effort from a lot of people, but one day people in this country woke up and even if they were poor, they could go and see a doctor for free. That is something that I would be really like the Beatles, you know, that the fact that like working class kids could go to art school in the late 50s and early 60s, form bands and then produce a band whose tax revenues are
exactly so economically advantageous. I was just thinking, I think we could try and get back to a week. There was a week I was thinking it was John Smith was still alive and was head of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
The Mini Metro was launched. The English football team was Lineker, Lee Dixon.
You really love Lee Dixon. The only thing that's really surprised me in this podcast is the amount of affection you have for Lee Dixon.
Well, I've only met him. I think I've met him twice. I've only the only footballer I've ever met, I think. Well, I've met Kenny Dalglish.
Do you not count Kenny Dalglish? Because
no, I do. Yeah,
everyone from Liverpool has met Kenny Dalglish.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you say mini metro?
The mini. I'm trying to conjure a kind of a sunlit week in the history of Britain when Britain was still an economic powerhouse. The mini metro. For you know, a nippy little hatchback. John Smith, a benign and you know, decent person, morally decent social democrat, a football team, you know, infused with that talent in very short
Lineker, make Lee Britain Dixon. Make Britain October 1980 again.
1980. Yes, yeah, there you go. That was it. If we could just fucking get back to the October 1980.
M-O-N-A.
Had the Clash released London Calling? I think London Calling might come out that year.
Probably.
It's a great album.
Mabona would be the an acronym.
somewhere in Crouch End, Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart were working on the lyrics for,
Sweet Dreams.
Sweet Dreams. Studio, in a home studio in Crouch End on an 8-track cassette machine, Dave Stewart and Annie Lennox are working on the lyrics of Sweet Dreams. A young comedian called Lexi Sale is failing to sell out the White Rock Theatre in Hastings. The mini metro is launched. Later that year, he will meet Lee Dixon backstage at Have I Got News For You. That was later. So let's aim for that, I think. There's a single week when that we reach that pinnacle of Britain, and then from then on, it's been a descent. John Smith.
Let's not fool ourselves. These, you know, these fucking fascists have always been around. They've just never had... They've just got the self-assuredness now that they shouldn't deserve, that they shouldn't fucking be... It is scary, but like...
It definitely feels
I've seen firsthand how violent and gruesome these people can be just by the way you look. You know, I've seen some... In Ealing. Not even... You don't have to even have to go up north to see
Ealing.
It. I saw a brown guy. I was 15 years old in the early 2000s. I was on a double-decker bus in Ealing, and I heard a ruckus happening downstairs. And me and my friends, we all ran down the stairs to see what's going on. There's these three blokes just beating on this brown chap
Jesus.
On the bottom decker and just absolutely pummeling the shit out of him. And his white girlfriend Jesus was with Christ. Him and she was like going, please stop. And everyone on the bus was just sitting there watching until finally the fucking bus driver came out of his little booth and like opened the door and like manhandled them out. And he was the only other ethnic minority on the fucking bus, him, me, and this guy getting his head kicked in. Everyone's just watching. And then I realized, he's sitting with a white girlfriend and they must have been offended by that.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm walking, I have a white girlfriend. I was born here. I like white girls. And, but like, I have You're a white so girlfriend. I live with her and I can't help but feel actually intimidated and scared by what I'm seeing on our fucking streets, you know? And even you think, a flag is harmless. I'm just showing my patriotism, but we know the subtext of that, and it is intimidating.
Well, and also the premise of these marches. I think, you know, we thought, well, everyone's tying themselves in knots about how to talk about this without, you know, because you have to try and persuade at least some of these people to, you know, that this is not in their best interests. You know, like this, it's like Tommy Robinson and Elon Musk are not working in the best interests of the white working class in this country. Like that's just.
No,
you know, that's it should be self-evident, but it isn't. But also it's difficult to explain to people. I was at the Stop Trump March thing yesterday, and a guy came up to a bunch of us and was saying, look, I was at the Tommy Robinson march on Saturday, and I think that you a lot of the characterization of it is unfair. And the thing that I was trying to communicate to him was, you know, that intent of that, with so much talk about the Gaza marches, hate marches, this, that, and the other. Yeah. The premise of those marches, the premise of why they're being organized is to protest murdering children. Really, at its core, it is to protest the murdering of defenseless civilians, right? That's why they're there. The premise of the Tommy Robinson, what is the premise of the Tommy Robinson march? The premise of it is that this immigrants are a drain on British resources at its core. And that is demonstrably and has been demonstrated on many occasions to be untrue. So if you're propagating that myth, then what is that if not racism? So whether people on the march are or are not racist, the premise of the march, the idea on which that convening of people has happened is at its core racist.
Yeah. That's a very Absolutely. Good summation of, yeah, because sometimes you do, as you say, you do, there are people who who are not maligned, who are on that demonstration, but they're being seduced into a maligned ideology, aren't they? Marx predicted all this, of course. Simple dialectical. He said I'll do the answer next week. And then he went out and died of his carbuncle. So he never came back and said what the answer was. I've got the fucking answer, right? This is, dialectical historical materialism says, you know, a gradual move towards autocracy. But next week on the Das Kapital podcast, we'll do how we're going to fix it. And he never did it. He died.
Shit. Anything to listeners at home, like, you know, this shit isn't harmless. And if you hear people talking bollocks, fascist, racist shit
in the pub,
like, you know, it is on you, unfortunately. Like, have the balls to stand up and tell them.
It's on all of us.
Shit.
Yeah.
It's all of our responsibility. You know, like, it's a collective responsibility. Because the thing is, if Farage takes power and if Reform are in charge, it's terrible for them. Like, you look at America is suffering because, you know, Trump can't finance tax cuts without cutting Medicaid. Like, poor Americans are absolutely suffering here.
Yeah.
I'm now also slightly distracted by imagining Karl Marx having to say, and join us next week on the Das Kapital podcast. In the meantime, the
Engels will be back, yeah.
If you're a HelloFresh is a great
what fucking adverts would he have?
is a way of, yeah. If you're spending a lot of time trying to think about how to overthrow the capitalist system, HelloFresh actually takes a lot of the stress out of meal prep.
No, he wouldn't. He'd be like us. He'd never had adverts and just rely on Patreon supporters. We have to wrap. We have to get to the end. So actually, I need to promote our Patreon. This is the only advert we do on the show. Is please support this show. It's a grassroots show. We have no budget, no adverts, and we never want to have adverts. So please head to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. That's patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast to support the show. I am, in fact, because we've had a couple weeks off recently, I wanted to make up for it by finally pulling my finger out, and I'm editing episode 2 of Alexi, Lisa, and Nigel Watch the Young Ones. And so that is currently going to go on the Patreon very shortly, and it will be only for Patreon subscribers. So sign up there.
Lucky people.
We can't end without asking Nish a bit about his podcast, Pod Save.
Yeah, well,
UK.
I was going to say, is there anything you want to?
Yeah, please listen to
Angry Loners.
Please listen to Pod Save the UK. A good episode to start would be the one that came out 3 weeks ago, because it features a conversation with Jen Brister and Alexi Sayre. And it was a Gaza special that we did in collaboration with Amnesty International. It was a great chat. But yeah,
also had Mr. Dahdouh on there.
It was an extraordinary conversation.
I mean, to be in the presence of that man, a man who has suffered so
incredible,
so many different levels, it was really special.
I kind of wanted to try and fit in asking you some advice for podcasting, not podcasting, but like growing an audience and stuff. But yours is like a spin-off of an American
one, ours is a spin-off.
And your first episode was, you got to sit with Jon Favreau and like
ours is a spin-off show. Like, I have no good advice about podcasting from like it's the whole thing is a mystery to me. Like, I'm a kind of first generation podcast listener because of my age, and you sort of you know, I still listen to the same 10 podcasts I did about 10 years ago.
Same, man.
Mark Maron fucking stopping same. Podcasting is like genuinely interfering with my weekly schedule. I'm happy for the guy, but still, fuck him.
When you were at the BBC, did they invite you to shit? Did they like invite you to Wimbledon? Did you have a connection with the
I didn't go to Wimbledon. I would just love to go to love the tennis. I love the tennis.
I got one visit to the proms.
Wow.
At the BBC once.
Wow.
I've never been invited back since.
Well,
I don't know why I bring that up, really. I just thought because you had this successful show on the BBC for years, they might have.
My relationship with the BBC whilst I was hosting that successful show was a little.
Was it? They sent me a thing the other day. It was from something like the Environmental Comedy Unit.
Yeah.
And it was like it's a division of the BBC or something that I think is supposed to wring humour out of environmental issues, and they wanted me to come down to the Wellcome Institute and do a kind of speed dating thing. There'd be drinks and canapes.
Yeah.
And then I'd sit with a variety of ecological influencers and talk about how we could ecological issues. I mean, I would just say, you know, your monopoly capitalism is the root of all evil next. I mean, so I don't think it just made me laugh that they've got this, whatever the fuck it. Also that they invited me to it. I've been at the BBC. Did you have a staff pass?
I never had a staff pass.
I've never ever. Yeah, you did. Yeah, that's right. But I've never ever had to not argue my way into the BBC to do my own show. Every week. I mean, when I was doing stuff, it was like, I'm recording.
Yeah.
You're not on the list, mate, Mr. Doyle.
It was funny. I used to, because there was a point where I was actually, even like before the TV show, when I used to host a radio show for them. And so, you know, it was like, it would run sort of 12 weeks of the year. And it was like 3 months of my year, really. And no pass.
No.
No way, man.
If they can, they bring you on as freelance rather than staff.
Yeah.
Well, my years at the BBC consisted of getting shouted at for things that weren't in my control, listening to Paul Daniels being casually racist, and watching dancers sexually harass each other on Strictly.
Oh, my God. Jesus Christ.
Yours sounds way better.
Still, is an institution worth defending?
Yeah,
I still defend the BBC. It's really important.
It's like an abusive marriage. Jim Davey comes around and says, "You're fucking fat. You're not going out wearing that, are you? Mark off. This food tastes like shit."
Yes, Tim. Thank you, Tim. Yes, Tim.
All right, Nish, thank you very much. It was fantastic. I think we really covered some interesting ground there.
Thanks, everybody. Nice to see you both. See you
that
soon.
Was really nice.
Amen.
Free Palestine.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.